Hi, my name is Dr. John Duyard. I'm an Ayurvedic practitioner and founder of LifeSpa.com, where we prove ancient medical wisdom with modern science. And today I want to talk about the science of subtle energy from the Ayurvedic perspective. And to give you a better sense of Ayurveda, if this is your first time hearing about Ayurveda, Ayurveda sort of has two definitions. Ayu means life, Veda means science, so it has to do with the science of life. How to live your life in harmony with the natural cycles of nature, going downstream with the current, circadian medicine, daily routines, seasonal routines, diet, exercise, herbs, to keep this physiology in balance. So we can then appreciate the second definition of Ayurveda, where Ayu is life and Veda means truth, the science that never changes. And when you think about Ayu being life and Veda means truth, it's about the truth of your life, letting something more real and more authentic out. Studies show that 95% of the things we think and say and do as adults come from impressions from the first 6 years of life, suggesting that many of us are sort of unconscious in that we are engaging in behaviors and thoughts and actions based on impressions we experienced when we were children. And when we were children, we were pretty vested in getting mom and dad to love us and appreciate us and approve of us. And we were hardwired for that, because if we didn't care if mom and dad liked us or looked over us, we would have wandered into the jungle, got eaten by lions, and there'd basically be no people here, right? So we need that need of approval and appreciation to survive. But traditional cultures would do something called a rite of passage, where children would grow up and start to realize that they have to stop needing to be loved and approved of, like a leopard would say, the mama leopard say, you know, you're going to be on your own now, don't follow me around. And we would stop needing that approval and love and appreciation from others and start giving it and caring for others. And this is a rite of passage that our culture sort of never got the memo about. Our culture is about giving you more stimulation, more reward chemistry, addicting us to our senses and things that satisfy us from the outside. Ayurveda of you, the truth of you, is to let something more real and more authentic out. And that's where the science of subtle energy comes in. The idea in Ayurvedic medicine is that this human body is an instrument to perceive subtle energy in ways that no technology has yet to accomplish. And the whole idea of the first definition of keeping your body in balance and functioning well is so we have this body that is functioning in a healthy manner. As we get older and become more wise, we call it the wisdom years in Ayurveda, where the body goes from kind of the early part of our life where we're very earth and water and we're structurally strong to the fire time of our life, the pitta where we make things happen and change the world and make a living and raise our children, to the vata, air and akasha, space and ether time of our life in the last third, where we literally constitutionally have the ability to perceive subtle energy in a way that is really quite profound. Now, when you read the Ayurvedic texts, they talk about, and other texts do too, talk about immortality, this idea of living forever. And from the Ayurvedic perspective, it's not about this human form, this flesh is going to last forever, but the energy of it can and will from the Ayurvedic perspective. The soul, for example, never dies. The mind and the thoughts we have are energy and they continue. So the idea in Ayurveda was that we could be, if we begin to use this body as an instrument perceiving subtle energy in the way it was designed, maximizing our potential, using the tools I'm going to teach you today, become realized passengers on this journey of the soul. That it doesn't have to have, we don't have to have this thing called the soul and the spirit that we know nothing about until we die. We can actually begin to experience that now while we're here. And in the last third of your life, as you go into the wisdom years, we're hardwired to make that happen. Even if you lived a pretty stressful life early on, Ayurveda was designed to bring the body back into balance so this human mind, central nervous system, has that ability to perceive that energy in ways that can give us, you know, sort of find God before it's too late. Have that spiritual life that is so rewarding and so fulfilling, right? So to take this a little further, I want to talk about what Ayurveda calls the cause of disease. And it's called Pragya Aparadha, which means the mistake of the intellect, where the intellect makes a mistake and starts to think of itself as separate from the underlying field of intelligence or consciousness from which we come. Quantum physics, you know, pretty much agrees and accepted certain theories like the zero-point field theories and unified grand unified field theories, which suggest that everything in creation comes from a field, vibrations of this field. And they concentrate these vibrations into physical form or to matter. And at that some point, there's going to be a place where the field becomes physiology, where the consciousness, which is the field, becomes matter. And at the junction point between consciousness and matter is the place that Ayurveda said is where we can treat the cause of disease. Because when the physiology has forgotten that it comes from an underlying field of consciousness, then the healing or the treatment for the cause of disease, the mistake of the intellect where the mind has forgotten that it's part of a field of intelligence, how do you restore that smriti or that memory? Well, you put yourself right at the gap, right at the junction point. It's called sandhi in Ayurveda, at the junction point between field and physiology or consciousness and matter. And if you put yourself at the junction point, it's like putting a light or a lamp in a doorway. The light shines both into the room and to the hallway. In the same way, if you put your awareness using certain awareness techniques that are backed by science that I'm going to talk about in a minute, and they're called sandhi techniques or gap techniques, and you put your attention at that level, you're perceiving subtle energy. But you're shining that awareness both into the field of consciousness from which we come, and you're infusing that consciousness into the physiology that has lost its way. So it turns out that the treatments in Ayurveda that are designed to address the cause of disease is the ones that restore the memory of pure consciousness into the physiology by putting attention at the junction point between field and physiology. Well, turns out that in Ayurveda there are many techniques that are focused on the gap or the sandhi, something called Ritu Sandhi, which means the gap between the seasons. In the Vedic text, it says that 7 days before the season ends and the 7 days of the new season is when disease has its most powerful foothold. That's when disease begins to take place. Pranayam techniques, prana means breath, and yam means to pause or the hold. So the gap between the breath, which we're going to talk in a little bit more detail about in a minute, is such a powerful tool that we'll dive into. Marma therapy are the point therapies in Ayurveda, and they're considered junction points between nerves and arteries and veins, but they're also considered junctions between consciousness and matter. The meditation is a technique where you take your thoughts, the thoughts that we have, the incessant thinking, and drop it down into that field of intelligence or consciousness. And we play with that gap between thoughts and non-thoughts. And that's what meditation does and why it is so, so profound. There's something called Kala Sandhi, which is the gap between the different times of day. In Ayurveda, the circadian rhythms change from one time of day to the other. It's Nobel Prize winning science that there's biological clocks that are supposed to be in sync with the natural circadian rhythms. And they take place throughout the different times of day. In the morning, in what we call the kapha or spring time of the day after sunrise, the body's structurally more strong. And then in the midday, it transitions into more digestive heat, where we have our biggest meal in the middle of the day, as most traditional cultures did, right? Well, that transition of the manifest of the kapha moving into the energy of digestive fire or pitta takes place through the gap. And in Ayurvedic pulse diagnosis, which was considered to be a therapy as well as a diagnosis, it was quite profound. And in the model of the pulse is like a lake. At the bottom of the lake is your constitutional body type that never changes. Like the bottom of the lake is very stable. The top of the lake is always moving and constantly changing throughout the day. And that represents your body constantly changing. Well, Ayurveda says that deeper pulse, the constitutional pulse, represents consciousness, and the surface pulse represents matter or your physiology. And in the pulse, there's a junction point between those two pulses. And if you put your attention at that junction point, powerful things, self-healing begins to happen. And I'll tell you a story about that. When I was teaching an Ayurvedic pulse course back in the late 1980s in California, in LA, during one of the courses, we had about 30, 40 people in the room teaching how to do self-pulse diagnosis so they can kind of bring their bodies back into balance. One of the guys fainted in the middle of the pulse course. And we helped him, you know, get up and get ready. And he said he wanted to finish the course, so he took a little bit of rest. We restarted the course, and afterwards I talked to him. I said, "Gosh, are you okay?" And he said, "You know, it's really weird because I've only fainted once before in my life, and that was in Mexico about 10 years ago. And what was interesting was that I had this feeling of faint back then, and I blacked out and got nauseous and kind of really clammy and blacked out. And that was the only time I ever fainted in my life. And ever since that day 10 years ago, I've had this pain in my mid-back and my liver area. And I've had been to doctor after doctor and healer after healer. I came to this pulse course with the same goal to help get rid of this pain. And in the middle of this course, I started feeling clammy and nauseous, the same feeling I had 10 years ago, which was really weird. And I just completely blacked out. And I said, "Wow." I said, "Well, can I give you my, this way before cell phones, can I give you my number? Can I have your number?" And I said, "I call you in a week or so to make sure you're okay." And he said, "Yeah, that'd be great." So I call him up a week or two later and I say, "Are you okay? How's it going?" He goes, "You know what? The most amazing thing happened." I said, "What?" "Ever since I fainted in your pulse course, that pain in my mid-back and my liver area is gone. And it hasn't come back." And I would go to LA and see this guy on a regular basis way back then, and that pain never came back. And this is what's called gap therapy or Vedic healing therapy. These are the therapies of the gap, which are really critically important. Pranayama, the gap between the breath, we'll talk about in a minute, is another gap therapy I want to talk about. But I want to talk about something that might actually enlighten us all, and that is the power of light from a perspective of healing at the junction point. Well, it turns out that there are these emissions from our cellular structure, from our DNA, called ultra-weak bio or photon emissions, or biophotons. And we release thousands of them out of our body every minute. And they can be, and they're information-carrying particles that carry information all throughout our body. And in fact, they carry information in our brain and our central nervous system along the myelin sheaths. The studies show that these photons are carried at the speed of light, that their thinking in the scientific literature is why we became so intelligent versus other creatures who didn't become quite as intelligent. And that the higher form species that have more intelligence have more of these biophotons being carried by the myelin sheaths to carry information extremely fast, much faster than a nerve and an axon and a nerve to a nerve to a nerve, which just takes time. It's fast, but nothing like the speed of light. Well, it turns out that these biophotons are photons. And by definition, they are both particles, particles of light, but they're also waveforms. So they're, by definition, photons exist as both field and physiology. They exist at both as a field of a light field, or they function as a particle. So when we talk about the cause of disease, pragya prat, where the consciousness becomes matter and the matter forgets that it's part of consciousness, that takes place at the junction point between field and physiology. So if you could find something that is both field and physiology, both particle and waveform at the same time, and use that to enhance your attention or awareness at that junction point, at that lamp in the door, you can create awareness into both the field and the physiology and restore the memory of pure consciousness at every cell of your body and restore what Ayurveda called the cause of disease, right? Well, that's exactly what these biophotons do. Turns out that these biophotons are both coherent and they can be incoherent. So they can be extremely damaging. So if you are radiated or you're under a lot of stress or you age and you have DNA damage, this can cause a lot of damage to the body. So it turns out that when the DNA is damaged, the photon releases are very incoherent and very damaging. So there's something called the bystander phenomenon, where they actually had a monkey that had cancer and they had irradiated it to help cure the cancer. They put it in the cage next to a healthy monkey, and after 48 hours, they measured the transference of the biophoton damage, the release of the biophotons from one monkey to another, and caused significant damage in the healthy monkey. My point is that our bodies are both transmitters and receivers of this of these biophotons. And if you have a lot of damaging DNA and damaging or incoherent photons, they can actually cause damage. But on the flip side, studies with yoga and breathing and meditation have been shown to create what are called not incoherent biophoton release, but coherent biophoton release. And what's even more amazing is that these biophotons have recently been shown to be affected by our intention. And by having an intention, these biophotons are changed. And they can actually carry, and they're carried at, at great distances. So this is something Einstein called entanglement, or spooky action at a distance, where if particles are entangled, that if I observe a particle here, it can instantly change a particle at great distances at the speed of light, or possibly even faster. So this gives us some information about how prayer, how distance healing, and how even the placebo effect could actually work. Because if you have an intention, and you impart that intention during a prayer or a meditation, which we know creates coherent biophotons, you can actually have a situation where you're actually releasing coherent biophotons that are carrying this intention at great distances, at the speed of light or faster, that can have an impact on the person that you're giving the intention to. Studies show, this is called the Bokun hypothesis, but studies show that that intention can create biophysical images in the person that you're having the intention for. Now, prayer has been studied in many, many cases, and it shows that it actually has incredible effects, and sometimes it works amazingly well, but there are studies showing it doesn't work at all. Distance healing, same kind of thing. In India, distance healing is a very common thing where you go to a distance healer and he takes your pulse, looks at a picture, and then they heal the person from a distance, in a distant land, you know, from a distance. Placebo is something that works through the intention. But if you are in a meditation or in a deep prayer, and you're creating coherent biophotons, it could explain why some studies on prayer work and others don't. Because if you're really stressed out about it, you could actually have a situation where you're not actually releasing coherent biophotons, and the damaging is creating a certain level of sort of interference, like a radio interference, because these are particles of light that travel at great, great distances, right? So let's talk about the placebo effect for a second. Studies show, they did a study with medical students, and they gave 50 of these medical students a sugar pill. They told half the group they were getting a stimulant, and they told the other half they were getting a sedative. Only three of the 50 medical students said they felt nothing. The rest of them had extreme reactions to the fake stimulant pill and the fake sedative pill. Some of them were sleepy and too tired to go to class and really feeling sedated. Other ones were feeling they were having anxiety attacks and felt like they were overdosed with the stimulant that they were given. This has a lot to do with how these biophotons are infected by our intention. If someone gives you a pill, you have that intention, I'm going to get better, and therefore you do. In one study, they showed that it was a drug that they used for depression and anxiety, and seven out of the eight studies, the placebo pill actually outperformed the actual drug that they were trying to approve, and only one of the trials did it actually outperform the placebo, and just because it outperformed the placebo just one time, it became an approved drug. In another study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, found that people with knee surgeries, they gave a group of 240 people who needed a knee surgery, one-third of the group got a surgery. The other third of the group, they opened it up and they kind of cleaned it out, washed it up inside. And the other group didn't get a surgery. They cut them open and stitched them right back up, and they didn't get the surgery at all. All of them had phenomenal results and never had any pain thereafter. Years later, they went and checked on this group and told them that some of the groups actually didn't get the surgery, but they were still feeling all these amazing benefits. So we may have a mechanism for understanding how prayer, how distance healing, how the placebo actually works, and it's called these biophotons, which are affected by our intention, which are both particles and waveforms, which function at the level of the field and the physiology at the same time. And if you put your attention at this level, you can begin to have more enhancement at that time, which turns out to be something that we can do. Light, for example, turns out to be sort of really important. I was reading a study not too long ago. It was about the Hadza tribe in Tanzania, the Tasami from Bolivia, and the Sounds Bushmen. And they measured their like daily routines and seasonal routines, and they put monitors on them throughout these different seasons. And one of the studies they did, they measured how much light exposure they had and when they got the light exposure throughout the year. And it turned out they got most of their light, the vast majority of their light, in the morning hours, and very little of the light in the middle of the day. Now, most of us Westerners, right, we sleep in, miss the morning light. We go out in the middle of the day and lie on the beach and try to get a tan or whatever, and we're out in the middle of the very hot sun, where the traditional cultures, you didn't really do that. Well, it turns out that that morning light is kind of really special. It turns out that the light changes throughout the day. And in the morning, that red sunrise light that you have is mostly red and infrared light. And red and infrared light is very penetrating. It penetrates deep into our tissues and actually has a very powerful healing effect. In fact, that infrared light is so healing that it prepares the body for the UV radiation that comes when the sun reaches the middle of the sky. The morning is sort of a time where you don't have much of the UV radiation, so the damaging rays are dialed down significantly where the red and infrared light is there. Well, it turns out that that red and infrared light penetrates the tissues inches into the body, even through our skull, and activates the cell's mitochondria to make energy, ATP energy. The energy we need to think and move and all that is activated by the sun through an enzyme called the cytochrome C oxidase, which changes that cellular sun's energy into ATP, or physiological energy. Sort of like plants have photosynthesis, we have this. And it's new science, but it explains how light gets turned into energy. Well, the energy production in the body has actually got some waste products, like any electrical plant, power plant. There's waste they have to deal with. Same thing in the body. And it's called reactive oxygen species, or free radical damage. And the body had to figure out a way to get rid of all this free radical damage. And as we age, we produce less of these antioxidants to protect ourselves. And as therefore, we can't produce as much energy because we can't get the trash out as well, right? So as a result of that, we age in a more rapid way, or even get diseases in more of an accelerated manner. So it turns out that the free radicals that the body uses to actually sop up all the free radical damage from energy production is called melatonin. And that's different than the melatonin that we make in our pineal gland to regulate our circadian rhythms with our biological clocks. That is only 10% of the melatonin that's produced in the body. 90% of the melatonin produced in your body is made from the sun, the same sun that stops us from making melatonin at night and affects our sleep. The same sun activates through infrared light, activates the melatonin, activates the melatonin in the cells that does this free radical damage, which is why it's so important for us to get that morning sunlight, just like traditional cultures did. And what's even more important is it turns out that that sunlight is what activates the coherent release of the biophotons. Light brews light inside of our body. So those photons, which exist at the junction point of consciousness and matter, field and physiology, which can be used to heal the body at very, very deep levels, even at great distances, is something that exists at the that we get from being exposed to more sunlight. So please start to be appreciative of the sunlight that we have and get out in the sun, not the midday sun. Get under a tree, get the shade. You'll still get the infrared light at that point, which is very, very important. Studies also show that these biophotons are carried along the myelin sheaths, which support higher vibration and higher intelligence. Well, one of the ways to make sure that our biophotons are functioning in the brain to give us higher vibration, higher cognitive function, to refine that human instrument so we have perceived subtle energy in the way we can, is to get rid of the trash in our brain. So it turns out in the University of Virginia about 15 years ago, studies show that we have lymphatics called the glymphatic system that dumps about 3 pounds of plaque and garbage out of our head every year while we sleep. So if you don't sleep well, you don't drain your brain very well. If you don't have good lymphatic flow, you don't sleep very well. And so one of the strategies in Ayurveda was to clean out the brain lymphatics. Now, in Western medicine, if you said there was lymphs in the brain before 14 years ago, you were considered a quack. Well, Ayurveda talked about brain lymphatics thousands of years ago and found out that we're not really quacks. And they found out that there's a technique called nausea. Nausea is a technique that you sniff medicated oil into the brain and clean out the brain lymphatic system, which is like a mohawk haircut. And in Ayurveda, it was used for cleaning out old emotional trauma. In Western medicine, in the last 15 years, they've discovered that decongesting of the brain lymphatic system is, and congestion of the brain lymphatic system is linked to anxiety, depression, cognitive decline, inflammation, infection, and even autoimmune concerns, or what you might call a cytokine storm, where the immune system, as a result of an immune event, is either overzealous, sending hundreds of fire trucks to the fire on Main Street, or not as many as it should. And that can cause an immune compromise or an out-of-balance immune or compromised immune event, right? So the brain lymphatic system is a very important thing. Well, it turns out that the nausea therapies are very powerful for cleaning it out. It's using medicated oils to clean out the brain lymphatics. And on my website at lifespa.com, I have an article called Nausea, Sinus Cleansing and Emotional Baggage. And in Ayurveda, it was really all about cleaning out the brain lymphatics to get rid of old emotional trauma. I had a patient many years ago who had a goiter in her neck, was about the size of a grapefruit. And she came to me, she had hyperthyroidism, where her thyroid was very, very high. And we worked with her medical doctor to make sure she was safe. And we gave her Ayurvedic Panchakarma, which is a detox therapy that I administered for 26 years. And the nausea therapy was to clean out this brain lymphatics and remove a lot of old emotional trauma to become the Ayurveda of you, let the truth of you out, right? And that was the most important part of the Ayurvedic approach, was it wasn't just detox physically, it was to really get us to have a level of mental clarity so we can see patterns of behavior that we are engaged in, doing the same dumb thing again and again and again, but locked into those patterns that aren't serving us. And getting a level of mental clarity where you have to begin to see that I don't have to do the same thing again and again, I can actually take action to be free, to let my true self out. Instead of engaging in behavior to need love and approval and appreciation of everyone else, to manipulate people to like me or approve of me, I can actually just do me because it's my nature to do me. Well, that's what the goal of the treatment was. And she said after she did her third treatment of these nausea, and there's in the article and the video that's there, it tells you step by step how to do this treatment at home. And it turns out that after her third treatment, she was writing in her journal and she said she had this epiphany. And she said that she was abused when she was about 14 years old. And she said it was really weird was I completely blocked that experience out of my mind. And she said, but what was even more amazing was that when I was having this epiphany, I wasn't so affected by the actual event. I was much more struck by my life, by the awareness of my life before the event, this happy-go-lucky kid. And then my life after the event where I was, you know, stressed out, type A, you know, 90-hour week corporate executive, perfectionist, color-coded closet, everything had to be perfect. And that became my survival, to make sure everything was perfect. And then she looked at her life before this happy-go-lucky kid, this event, and then this stressed out experience. And she said, it wasn't worth it. It wasn't great, that experience, but it wasn't worth 20, 30 years of my life. And she said, I literally just dropped it, literally within 1 week. Her goiter was completely gone. You couldn't see it. True story. We checked her thyroid numbers. And it came down 200 points in that week. Within the next 6 to 9 months, her thyroid completely regulated. About 5 or 6 years after that, I saw her in a Christmas party in Denver for a friend of mine. And turned out she came running up to me with two kids in tow and wanted to thank me and introduce me to her children, which wouldn't have been there if it wasn't for this experience. So it turned out that this brain lymphatic thing, which Western medicine has just discovered, is really quite quite the buzz in the research community today. And Ayurveda had developed therapies thousands of years ago because 50% of this trash coming out of our brain dumps into the paranasal sinuses. So they use these sinuses to clean that out. Well, another therapy that's used for brain respiration and moving the waste out of your head and brain to give you higher vibration, more awareness at a subtle level, is breathing or pranayama techniques. Pranayama techniques, you know, are really powerful. Prana means breath, yama means to pause. So it means the pause between the breath. Now, if you read the Hatha Yoga Pradipika and the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, the yogic textbooks, they will tell you that prana means breath and yama means to pause. And if you don't pause or hold the breath, it's called kumbhak. It's not actually pranayama. So they said that the pranayama wasn't really a pranayama unless you did the breath hold. Well, what's so important about the gap between the breath? Well, the gap between the breath, like the gap between the pulse and the gap between the seasons, they all sort of fit into this Vedic philosophy of gap or junction point therapies between field and physiology, which is where the cause of disease takes place, right? That's where the beginning of the mistake of the intellect takes place. In the field, you're completely omnipresent, aware of everything. In the particles, you're now separated and you're functioning independent of the field, right? So these gap therapies are really quite important. So pranayama techniques are very important with either slowing down or beginning to practice breathing with a gentle and very comfortable breath hold. Well, it turns out that that breathing is fundamentally performed by your diaphragm. The diaphragm is the most important breathing muscle in the body, but it's much more than that. The diaphragm is the major pump for your entire lymphatic system. And the pump of the brain lymphatic system turns out to be, you got it, your breath. When people, one study with elite professional athletes, half of them did not have a diaphragm that was relaxing and contracting fully. As a result, most of us probably don't either. Because we're so sedentary and we sit and the rib cage sort of gets jammed as we sit into the front of the abdomen, the rib cage pushes the diaphragm into a downward position, a pre-contracted position. And how we breathe is when we breathe in, the diaphragm contracts, sucks, pulls down, and pulls the air in and inflates the rib cage. And as soon as the diaphragm relaxes, all the air comes flying out, right? So it's like a balloon. The rib cage has something called elastic recoil. And if the diaphragm didn't contract, the rib cage would get tighter and tighter and tighter and literally become a cage. But with diaphragmatic function, the rib cage becomes a massive pump for the whole lymphatic system, which is trying to take the trash out, trying to carry your immune system, trying to deliver fats, good fats, as baseline energy to every cell of your body. So if you're tired or lethargic or you swell or hold on to water or have brain fog or food intolerances or PMS issues, breast swelling, holding on to water, pain that moves around your body, allergies, hypersensitivity reactions, these are all classic lymphatic issues. So the breathing, the diaphragm, is a tool to actually get the whole lymphatic system moving. Women with breast cancer have significantly more congestion of the anterior diaphragmatic lymph nodes than women who don't. The diaphragm is the major pump for the lymph around the belly, and people have extra weight around their belly and hips is oftentimes due to congestion of the lymphatic system. So strengthening your diaphragm becomes really, really important. So doing diaphragmatic exercises with breath hold is one of the Ayurvedic breathing techniques called pratyaloma. Pratyaloma is a breathing technique used to strengthen your diaphragm. And the kumbhak is the breath hold that we do along the way. So the diaphragm is really important, and this breathing technique is so critically important that in every hospital in the world, they have techniques that they use called inspiratory muscle training. And inspiratory muscle training are little devices, plastic devices, you can get them online, that strengthen your diaphragm. And it turns out that they use them for heart failure, lung failure. It's approved for COVID before, during, and after. It's been shown to lower your blood pressure. And it's also been shown in about 10 different studies to reverse heartburn, GERD, and reflux. So you go to the doctor for your heartburn, and the doctor says, oh, you need a pill for this to fix your heartburn or your indigestion, and they give you a pill, and you get better. They don't tell you to do a breathing technique, but in their own journals with 10 different studies, it tells you that they can in fact, that you can in fact reverse your heartburn and your GERD and reflux by just doing this breathing technique that I'm going to show you in just a minute. So it turns out that that one study showed that most Americans and Westerners, when they breathe in, 75% of the oxygen that they breathe in, they breathe right back out, unused. So we're trying to jam in more oxygen, and we never can't really use as much because our oxygen is already 98% saturated in the blood, right? When you get an oximeter on your finger, it's like 98% saturation. You can't take any more. So you're over-breathing in oxygen and you're excessively breathing out carbon dioxide. So what happens to most of us is as the rib cage gets tighter and we start to shallow breathe, it turns out that we have higher levels of oxygen and low levels of CO2. Well, it turns out that when the CO2 levels are low, the bond, follow me here for a second, between the oxygen in your blood and the hemoglobin, becomes tighter. So if CO2 is low and oxygen is high, the bond between oxygen and blood is tight. And the tissues, we're trying to deliver the oxygen from your blood into your brain, into your muscles, into your heart, those tissues can become hypoxic, activating mutagenic stem cells that take advantage of not having enough oxygen in your tissues. And because we overbreathe and the rib cage has gotten tight and the diaphragm is not working, oxygen goes very high, which is anxiety provoking, CO2 levels go low, which is also anxiety provoking, and we end up having very little oxygen in the tissues and all the oxygen jammed into our blood, and we breathe out 75% of it because we can't really use it. Well, it turns out that if you were to see someone with an anxiety having a panic attack, you'd put a paper bag over their mouth, they would rebreathe CO2, and it would help calm them down. So it turns out that when you let your carbon dioxide levels begin to rise, not only do you get calm, and study in clinics in the 40s and 50s around the world would have people come in and breathe carbon dioxide mixed with oxygen to reverse their anxiety. And it worked phenomenally well and it was well studied, but now with all the pills and antidepressant and anxiety medications, they just shifted to that. But that didn't solve the problem of people sitting too much and not having good diaphragmatic function. So what happens is when you have poor diaphragmatic function, we have oxygen levels that go up, CO2 levels go down, and as you begin to practice Kumbhak or breath holding, the carbon dioxide levels begin to rise. And when they rise, that's the trigger to release the oxygen from your blood into the tissues to reverse the tissue hypoxia and give you, rejuvenative cell energy in your cells. And sunlight has been shown to amp up that efficiency of that process, which is another reason that we need to get outside. Studies show that most Westerners have what's called a infrared light deficiency. 70% of the light from the sun is infrared. That's a lot. And 90% of the time, most Westerners spend their days, 90% of their day, indoors, not getting any of that infrared light, which is why it's so important for us to get outside in a proper manner. And like our pre-industrial ancestors and cousins, really, they got most of their sunlight when it was safe to do that, which was in the morning hours, which is really, critically important. All right, so this breathing technique called pratyaloma is a technique that's used to strengthen your diaphragm. So let me explain it and show you how to do it real quick. It's very simple. So you're gonna sit up straight, and we're gonna breathe through our nose, and we're gonna just fill our belly first, and then our chest, and then our upper chest. And this is called maximal inspiratory training, or pratyaloma in Ayurveda. So we're gonna take a breath in through our nose, fill your belly all the way, fill your chest all the way, and then your upper chest, and then let it out. Do it again, fill your belly, and your chest, and your upper chest, and let it out. Now, when you do that this time, notice when you squeeze the last bit of air in, maximally in, you should feel underneath your rib cage your diaphragm contracting, right? So take a breath in, belly first, then your chest, upper chest, squeeze, feel that diaphragm, and let it out. So the Ayurvedic technique to make this a little bit more efficient is to create some resistance. So you can take your fingers and partially close your nostrils, about 80%, and then breathe in through partially closed nostrils. That's going to make your diaphragm work a little bit harder. So you take your fingers, belly, chest, upper chest, and let it out. Again, belly, chest, upper chest. Feel that squeeze of your diaphragm and let it out. And what I, what I'd ask you to do is take 10 of those breaths and see how that feels. If you get a little dizzy anywhere along the way, stop. And after your last breath, I want you to then breathe out and just hold your breath for 10 seconds or so, or a little bit longer, and see how long you can do it. And as soon as you have the littlest bit of urge to breathe, go back into another round of the pratyaloma and do that again. Do another 10 breaths of that. On the last exhale, hold your breath. And that time your breath is going to probably hold a little longer, and that's the kumbhak. That's the pause between the breath. Now what happens when you take that pause and the CO2 levels when you hold your breath start to rise because you're not breathing, right? And that's the trigger to release the oxygen from your blood into your tissues. But when the oxygen goes into your tissues and you're not taking another breath, what happens to the oxygen in your blood is it starts to go down. And when the oxygen in your blood starts to go down, this causes a little bit of an emergency. Alarm bells goes off in your brain and says, hey, we better breathe. In the same way that when we do calorie restriction or intermittent fasting and people don't eat as much, the studies show that it's one of the most powerful things we can do for our health. It triggers stem cell activation and autophagy and cellular recycling and all that. Because the body's thinking it's going to starve. The same thing happens when the body thinks it's not going to get enough oxygen. All the emergency vehicles come to do repair. And this is called intermittent hypoxia. Now I know you might hold your breath for 10 seconds or 30 seconds or something, but you have to realize that free divers, the record for holding your breath under the water is 25 minutes. I'm not expecting any of you guys to breathe or hold your breath for 25 minutes, but I am suggesting that that we have the ability to hold our breath for much longer. And when you do that and CO2 levels rise, that triggers the release of oxygen from your blood into your tissues. The tissues are happy, your brain, your heart, they're happy, but your oxygen levels start to go down, and when they go down from the high 90s to the mid 90s to the low 90s and into the 80s, you're in something called intermittent hypoxia. And that is the science of breath hold, the science of kumbhak, the science of the gap therapy between the breaths. And the studies show that when you do that, you increase stem cells, which are repair and rejuvenation and detox molecules that help keep us young and do the repair damage as we age. It's shown to increase what's called erythropoietin, or EPO, which is what Lance Armstrong got busted for injecting. Turns out you make your own when you just create a pause or hold your breath. It triggers the release of nitric oxide, which won the Nobel Prize in 1998. It's a panacea molecule that cures everything. It increases the release of what are called endothelial growth factors that keep the inside of your arteries really healthy and builds collateral circulation around your heart so you protect yourself from heart disease. It increases transcription factors, which are called the guardians of your genome, that protect you from getting exposure to genetic predispositions and expressing those traits. And when I did the research on all these pranayama techniques, what I found that one of the common denominators, what they all have, they change what's called neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity means changing those old mental emotional patterns of the brain. They do that by changing our brain waves. We did a study based on comparing nose breathing with mouth breathing and exercise back in the early 1990s and published in the International Journal of Neuroscience. And we found that people breathe through the nose, their brain goes into an alpha state, which is a meditative calm during vigorous exercise. So imagine being running as fast as you could, but your brain responding to that as a meditation. I call that the eye of the storm. The bigger the calm, the more powerful your winds. So the idea was that these breathing techniques allow you to, number one, give you brain respiration, get trash out of your head so you'll be more clear. That breathing is a powerful tool for neuroplasticity to actually create the ability to have clarity and awareness of not engaging in the same old patterns that we've done again and again and again, and start to take action to free ourselves from those old patterns. But the breathing, is also a very powerful tool for intermittent hypoxia, which includes, you know, the stem cells, the nitric oxide, you know, the increase of the EPO, or the erythropoietin, a hormone that supports longevity and energy and vitality, the guardian of your genome, and of course the neuroplasticity. So we can, and changing, of course, the brain waves, which changes our vibration. So we can have that ability to perceive subtle energy, refine this human instrument's perception of subtle energy, so we can do what we were designed to do. So that breathing technique, you can do two or three rounds of that, where you do 10 breaths, partially closed nostrils, with maximum inhales with partially closed nostrils. After your last exhale, hold your breath comfortably. Any dizziness at all, this is not an endurance event, not a competition. It has to happen gracefully. If you do force it and try to make it a competition, it's only going to undermine the success. That's the whole point of Ayurveda, is you bring the body into balance, and then the body takes care of business. It takes care of the awareness. You can't force the awareness. You can't force being kind and gentle and caring for others. And that is something that I want to kind of end with. And I wrote an article at lifespa.com called The Science of Sattva. Sattva means that state of being where you're kind and giving and caring for others. And the studies show that when people are kind and giving and caring for others, they live longer. Studies show that when they give altruistically to people who are poor, even poor people give to people who are even who have more money than them, and they're still giving, it shows that they become happier and they also live longer. Caregivers who care for others, in one study, if they gave to a friend or a family member within the last year, they lived significantly longer. And also it turns out that in the was study published in the British Medical Journal, study of over 4,000 people, and they found that when someone was happy, sattva means happy for no reason, not because something happened, you're happy, you're not unhappy because something bad happened, you're independent of the highs and lows, you're happy for no reason because it's your nature to be happy. And they found if someone was happy, that happiness was paid forward 3 degrees, which means that the person who was happy actually created happiness in their friend, and it also created happiness in the friends of the friends. And if the friends lived within a mile of each other, the friends of the friends' happiness was increased by 25%. This was published in the British Medical Journal with over 4,000 people, which means that our ability to be happy doesn't just affect us, it affects others. Studies show that, of course, when you're happy and you live a sattva, giving, caring for others' life, it's not all about give me more stuff and feed my senses with more things. It turns out that our good bugs proliferate, our bad bugs disappear. The hormone of longevity called oxytocin produces significantly when you give and care for others. Studies show that the telomeres, which are the caps on the chromosomes, lengthen when you give and care for others. When people meditate, which makes them more sattvic, dips the cloth in the dye of that consciousness, restores the memory of pure consciousness in the cells, that when by doing that, it increases the length of the telomeres, therefore lengthens your lifespan by 30% in one study and 43% in another. And maybe my favorite study of all is when they gave two groups of people, they were asked to give a gift in one way, in a hedonistic way, where they gave a gift to certain folks and they wanted to get something in return. They wanted some return on that investment. Like, I wanted the praise and the glory. I gave you this gift and don't you think I'm wonderful? Like, I had some self-interest in mind, some return on that investment. And the other group gave in a eudaimonic way, where they didn't have any expectation to get anything in return. They gave for the love of giving, period. And when they gave it a hedonistic way, it actually had a negative effect on the genetic code. But when they gave in a eudaimonic way, where they didn't have any expectation to get anything in return, it actually had a positive effect on the genetic code of the person they were giving it to. So it means that when you're engaging in behavior to manipulate them to like you, approve of you, or you're trying to be this way so they like me, they can tell that you're not real. They can tell that you're full of it. And that doesn't make them feel safe to open themselves up to be the truth of them. When you're engaging in behavior that's trying to manipulate them to be something, to be the way that you want them to be, they can tell that they're being manipulated. It has a negative effect on their genetic code. But when you actually give in a eudaimonic way and you give fully from your heart, they feel you. They feel safe because they're getting a dose of really you. It positively affects your genetic code, positively affects the good bugs in their gut, positively lengthens them their telomeres. And when they feel you, they feel safe to open the delicate petals of their flower and they let something real out. And that allows us to engage in the Ayurveda of us, the truth of us. They feel safe in that presence, then they feel safe to open up their hearts, their armor, and let the truth of them out. And now we have a communion. And in that communion, we have the ability to open each other's hearts and connect on the level of truth, on the level of love, on the level of sattva. And not only do we live longer, but that love and that caring for others and that expression of those actions is paid forward. And it actually affects the happiness and the sattva of others. And that's what I think our biggest responsibility is in the world of the science of subtle energy, is to realize it's not for you. The light that we carry are photons. They pass through us instantaneously. They're being shared with others at great distances instantaneously. Einstein called it entanglement. As I give this lecture, I am creating an intention on these biophotons about this content. As you are watching this lecture, or as you may have been exposed to thinking about watching it when you're watching it, that those biophotons that are hitting you, we're entangled because we're connected through this video. So the intention that I have could actually have an effect on you and create biophysical images inside of you that we're connected. Einstein called this spooky action at a distance. It's called entanglement. It's a very real thing, and biophotons are considered the mechanism of that entanglement, right? What's kind of neat also is it's not just traveling at the speed of light, because, you know, if I was entangled with someone in China, it takes a tenth of a second for the light to get there. But Einstein said this happens instantaneously, and that's been confirmed in quantum physics. So at the junction of the field, where the field meets the physiology, at the level of the field, the zero-point field theories, everything in creation comes from that place. At that level, we're all one. So having an intention at that level, at the level of the biophotons, we can have an impact on not only the physiology, but on the field. And that means that we can have an impact and an effect on everyone with our positive intention. But that intention can't be contrived. It has to come from living a sattvic life, living the practices of Ayurveda, being a kind, giving, sharing person. And that allows us to dip the dye, the cloth, into the dye of our own being and connect with others at this quantum level of biophotons, which was discovered in the 1930s by Einstein and now is cutting edge science, understanding things like prayer, distance healing, placebo, and our ability to be all connected. So please recognize our responsibility to be kind and to be giving and to care for others in the same way that you would want them to care for you. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. John DeYard.